Chapter 1, The Unearthed Secret. The sun rose slowly over the quiet university town, casting long shadows across the ivy-covered buildings. It was a morning like any other, still and serene, the kind of silence that lulled the townsfolk into believing their lives were untouched by darkness. Margaret Ellison, an avid gardener and an early riser, tugged gently at her dog's leash. "Come on, Daisy," she urged, her voice soft, but the dog wasn't moving. Instead, it stood frozen by the fence at the edge of the Herring estate, its nose buried in a patch of freshly disturbed soil. Margaret frowned, crouching to get a closer look. The dirt was uneven, the kind of mess left behind by something or someone digging in haste. Her breath caught. The earth beneath her fingertips felt unnaturally loose. Something was wrong. Standing quickly, she pulled out her phone and dialed. Her voice shook as she spoke. "Yes, this is Margaret Ellison. I think I found something. It's at the Herring place. Please, send someone right away." The police arrived within minutes. Yellow tape stretched across the yard, marking a boundary between the mundane and the sinister. Officers moved with purpose, their expressions grim as they gathered around the shallow grave. Detective Marlowe Gray stepped out of his car and surveyed the scene. Tall and broad-shouldered, he carried himself with a quiet authority, though his sharp eyes betrayed the weight of countless unsolved cases. "What have we got?" he asked, his tone clipped. Officer Daniels, standing near the edge of the pit, gestured toward the exposed remains. "Partial burial. Neighbor's dog uncovered it this morning." Marlowe leaned in, examining the scene with a practiced eye. The smell of damp earth hung heavy in the air. "And this is the Herring property?" Daniels nodded. "Yes, sir. Dr. Charles Herring, the professor." Marlowe's brow furrowed. He knew the name. Everyone did. Herring wasn't just a professor. He was a pillar of the community, a man revered for his intellect and charm. But now, his name would be tied to a headline that no one could ignore. Inside the Herring home, the air felt stale. Dust clung to the surfaces, untouched for days. Marlowe moved through the rooms with careful precision, his eyes scanning for anything out of place. In the study, he paused. The desk was cluttered, papers stacked in uneven piles, books left open as if their reader had been interrupted mid-thought. Among the chaos, a leather-bound journal stood out. Its cover was smooth, pristine, unlike the rest of the disarray. Marlowe opened it, his fingers brushing over the pages. At first, it seemed innocuous, academic notes, musings about lectures. But then he turned to a page that made his chest tighten. The handwriting, elegant and deliberate, read, "People trust too easily. They're blind to the subtle art of persuasion. But me, I see through it all, every weakness, every lie, and I use it." Marlowe exhaled slowly, his grip tightening on the book. This wasn't just a journal. It was something else entirely. Back at the station, Marlowe began piecing together the fragments of Herring's life. The man everyone thought they knew was a web of contradictions. Students described him as both inspiring and intimidating. Colleagues spoke of professional rivalries, cloaked in cordial smiles. Even his family painted a picture of a man impossible to please. When Eleanor Herring, Charles's wife, arrived for questioning, her hands trembled as she cradled a teacup. Her voice was barely above a whisper. "He left last week for a conference," she said, her words brittle. "Or at least, that's what he told me. I haven't heard from him since." Marlowe studied her closely. "And you didn't think to report him missing?" Eleanor's gaze dropped to the table. "He's done this before, disappeared for a few days, buried himself in work. I thought he'd come back." Marlowe leaned forward. "Did he have enemies?" She hesitated, her lips pressing into a thin line. "Charles? No, everyone loved him." But her voice wavered, and in that moment, Marlowe knew she was lying. The whispers around town grew louder. Among the faculty and students, stories emerged, tales of a man who thrived on control. Lila Carrington, one of Herring's brightest students, described him with a bitterness that cut deep. "He liked to play games," she said, her arms crossed defensively. "He'd make you feel special. He's like you were the center of his world. And then, just when you started to trust him," she snapped her fingers, "he'd tear you down." "And why would he do that?" Marlowe asked. Lila's smirk was cold. "Because he could." Late that evening, Marlowe returned to the journal. Each entry revealed a mind obsessed with power, manipulation, and control. But one passage stood out, a chilling warning that made his blood run cold. "If anything ever happens to me, Don't blame them. They're just pawns in my game. Marlowe's chair scraped against the floor as he stood abruptly. The words lingered in his mind, each one heavy with implication. What the hell kind of game was this? He muttered. Closing narration. And so the first layer of the mystery was peeled back. Dr. Charles Herring wasn't just a man, he was a puzzle, one whose pieces didn't fit together as neatly as they appeared. But the deeper Detective Marlowe Gray delved into the professor's life, the darker the truth became, because sometimes the victim isn't the victim at all. Chapter 2. The Encrypted Truth. The next morning, the town buzzed with whispers. A murder in their pristine, ivy-draped community? It was unthinkable. Students at the university walked in tight-knit groups, their heads bent close as they murmured speculations. Faculty meetings turned into unofficial brainstorming sessions about the mystery. The Herring estate, once a symbol of success and sophistication, now loomed as a chilling backdrop for their imaginations. Detective Marlowe Gray, however, wasn't interested in gossip. He was buried in a mountain of evidence that only seemed to deepen the enigma of Dr. Charles Herring. Scene 1. The journals. Marlowe sat at his desk, the leather-bound journal open before him. The entries were methodical, written with a precision that mirrored the man who penned them. Yet as he flipped through the pages, patterns began to emerge, patterns that hinted at something darker. Control is power. One passage read, "Trust is the leash. People will follow you into the fire if you make them believe it was their idea." Marlowe frowned. The journal wasn't just an account of Herring's life. It was a manifesto, a playbook for manipulation. The professor had treated his relationships like experiments, testing limits, pushing boundaries. The question was, who had finally pushed back? Amid the scrawled entries, Marlowe noticed a recurring symbol, a series of interlocking circles. It was faint, almost invisible, pressed into the corner of certain pages. He tapped his pen against the desk, his mind racing. Was it a code? A signature? And if so, what did it mean? Scene 2. Interview with Eleanor Herring. Eleanor returned to the station that afternoon, her composure notably improved. Her hands were steady now, her voice calm. But Marlowe wasn't convinced. The wife of a dead man shouldn't recover so quickly, not unless she had something to hide. "Mrs. Herring," he began, "how long have you and Dr. Herring been married?" 24 years, she replied smoothly. "And in all that time you never noticed anything unusual, any behavior that might suggest he had enemies?" Eleanor's lips curled into a brittle smile. Charles was difficult, arrogant, even. But enemies? No, he was respected. Marlowe leaned back in his chair, watching her carefully. Respected, loved, feared? Her smile faltered, just for a moment. "I don't know what you mean." He leaned forward, his tone soft but insistent. "Eleanor, I've read his journals. I know the kind of man he was. I need to know if there was anyone, anyone, who might have wanted him gone." She hesitated, her eyes darting to the floor. "Charles, he could be cruel, especially to the people he claimed to care about. But I didn't kill him, Detective, I swear." Marlowe didn't respond. He didn't have to. Her words had already confirmed what he suspected. Charles Herring had been a master at building walls, and the people closest to him had spent years trying to tear them down. Scene 3. A new suspect emerges. Later that evening, Marlowe's phone buzzed. It was Officer Daniels. "We've got someone here you'll want to speak with," Daniels said. "A student, name's Lila Carrington." Marlowe's brow furrowed. Lila. The name had come up before, whispered among faculty and students alike. She was brilliant, ambitious, and, according to rumor, dangerously close to Dr. Herring. When Marlowe entered the interrogation room, Lila was seated with her arms crossed, her expression defiant. She met his gaze without flinching. "You're not wasting any time," she said coolly. "I take it you think I killed him?" "I think you knew him better than most," Marlowe replied, taking a seat across from her. "And I think you know things about his life that you haven't shared yet." Lila smirked. "You mean his secrets? His little games? Of course I knew. Everyone did. The difference is I didn't let him win." Marlowe tilted his head. "Win?" Lila leaned forward, her voice lowering. "Charles liked control. He liked to make you think you needed him. But I figured him out. I stopped playing along, and he hated that. He told me I was ungrateful, that I'd regret it." She shrugged. "Maybe I did." "Where were you the night he disappeared?" Marlowe asked. "At a party," Lila replied without hesitation. "Ask anyone. They'll tell you." Marlowe studied her, noting the confidence in her voice. If she was lying, she was good at it. Scene 4, a shocking discovery. Back at the Herring estate, forensic teams continued their work. The backyard was a maze of footprints, the soil carefully sifted for clues. Late that night, one of the technicians found something, a metal box buried just a few feet from where the body had been discovered. Marlowe arrived on the scene within minutes. The box was old, its surface scratched and dented. Inside were stacks of papers, meticulously organized. He flipped through them, his pulse quickening. They weren't just academic notes or personal letters. They were contracts, deals, agreements that tied Charles Herring to some of the most powerful and dangerous figures in the town. And then, at the bottom of the box, Marlowe found a photograph. It was faded, but the faces were unmistakable. Charles Herring and Lila Carrington, standing together, their expressions tense. Closing narration. The more Marlowe uncovered, the more tangled the web became. Charles Herring wasn't just a victim. He was a puppet master, pulling strings that no one else could see. But as the secrets of his life came to light, one thing became clear. Someone had cut those strings, and they weren't finished yet. Chapter 3, The Puppet Master's Web. The photograph haunted Marlowe. Dr. Charles Herring and Lila Carrington standing together, closer than any professor and student should be. Their faces told a story of tension, perhaps even betrayal. The photograph wasn't just a clue. It was a window into a relationship that defied boundaries. Marlowe returned to the station, the metal box and its contents in tow. He needed answers, and Lila Carrington was the key. But first, there was the matter of the contracts. They were written in Herring's precise hand, outlining transactions that hinted at blackmail. Scene 1, the blackmail trail. Marlowe spread the contracts across his desk, scanning each one. Names, dates, dollar amounts, all meticulously documented. The recipients included university faculty, prominent town officials, and even a few business owners. It was clear. Herring had built a network of leverage, using secrets as currency. One name stood out, Dean Harold Whitman, the head of the university. Marlowe didn't hesitate. He grabbed his coat and headed straight to Whitman's office. Scene 2, confronting the dean. The office smelled of polished wood and aged leather, a space meant to intimidate. Dean Whitman sat behind his desk, his expression carefully neutral as Marlowe entered. "Detective Gray," Whitman said smoothly. "To what do I owe the pleasure?" Marlowe dropped one of the contracts onto the desk. "You recognize this?" Whitman glanced at the paper, his face betraying nothing. "It appears to be some sort of agreement. Between you and Charles Herring," Marlowe pressed. "He had something on you, didn't he?" Whitman's jaw tightened. "This is absurd. Charles was ambitious. Yes, but blackmail? That's a serious accusation." "Serious and true," Marlowe shot back. "The question is, what was he holding over you? And how far were you willing to go to keep it hidden?" Whitman hesitated, the composure he'd maintained for years beginning to crack. "Charles knew things. About me. About the university. But I swear to you, detective, I didn't kill him." Marlowe leaned in, his voice low and sharp. "If you're lying to me, I'll find out, and when I do, you'll regret it." Whitman's silence was all the confirmation Marlowe needed. Back at the station, Lila Carrington sat in the interrogation room, her arms crossed and her expression guarded. She'd been summoned again after the photograph was discovered, and Marlowe wasn't going to let her leave without answers. He placed the photograph on the table between them. "Explain this." Lila's eyes flicked to the image, her lips pressing into a thin line. "It's just a picture." "No," Marlowe said firmly. "It's more than that. You and Herring weren't just student and professor. You were involved, weren't you?" She scoffed, but her voice wavered. "Don't be ridiculous." "Lila," Marlowe said, his tone softening, "I need you to be honest with me. Whatever it is, whatever happened between you and Charles, it could help us find out who killed him." For a moment, she said nothing. Then she exhaled sharply, her defenses crumbling. "Fine. Yes, we were involved, but it wasn't what you think. He wasn't who everyone thought he was." Marlowe leaned forward. "What do you mean?" Lila's voice dropped to a whisper. "He was controlling, manipulative. He used people, students, colleagues, even his own family. And when he was done with you, he made sure you felt it." Marlowe studied her, his mind piecing together the fragments of her story. "Did you hate him?" "Yes," she admitted, her eyes blazing. "But I didn't kill him. If anything, I'm glad he's gone, but it wasn't me. Scene 4. A disturbing revelation. That evening, Marlowe returned to his office. The pieces of the puzzle were starting to fit together, but the picture they formed was darker than he'd imagined. Herring wasn't just a victim. He was a man who thrived on control and manipulation, leaving a trail of enemies in his wake. As he reviewed the journal again, he noticed something he hadn't seen before, a faint imprint on one of the pages. He held it up to the light, revealing a hidden message etched into the paper. "The truth is buried deeper than you think." The words sent a chill down his spine. Herring had left a clue, one that suggested the game wasn't over. Someone had silenced him, but not before he ensured his secrets would continue to haunt those who betrayed him. Closing narration. Dr. Charles Herring had spent his life mastering the art of manipulation, weaving a web of deceit that ensnared everyone around him. But even in death, his game continued. Who had the most to lose if the truth came out? And how far would they go to keep it buried? Next time on Beneath the Ivy, the past resurfaces, the suspects grow bolder, and the stakes reach deadly new heights. Chapter 4, Buried Lies. The town's unease had morphed into outright fear. The news of Dr. Charles Herring's death and the web of manipulation he had spun spread like wildfire. Behind closed doors, whispered conversations turned accusatory. Everyone seemed to have a theory, a suspect, a reason to be afraid. Detective Marlowe Gray wasn't interested in theories. He needed evidence. And as the pieces of the puzzle began to align, he felt the weight of the truth creeping closer. There was something about Herring's last journal entry, the cryptic warning etched into the page, "The truth is buried deeper than you think." Marlowe couldn't shake the feeling that it wasn't just a metaphor. Scene 1, the second burial. Marlowe returned to the Herring estate with a forensic team, determined to dig deeper, literally. The first grave had yielded the professor's body, but something about the layout of the backyard seemed off. A patch of ground near the garden showed subtle signs of disturbance, as if it had been turned over recently. "Start here," he instructed, his voice steady. The team began to dig, their movements precise. Hours passed, and Marlowe's patience began to wane. But just as doubt crept in, one of the technicians called out, "Detective, we found something." The team unearthed a second box, smaller than the first but far more ominous. Its metal casing was rusted, and a faint smell of decay wafted from within. When they pried it open, the contents were chilling: photographs, letters, and a small bundle wrapped in fabric. Marlowe unfolded the bundle carefully, revealing a blood-stained handkerchief. Embroidered on the corner was a name: Lila Carrington. Scene 2, Lila's interrogation. At the station, Lila Carrington sat in the interrogation room, her usual composure unraveling. Marlowe placed the blood-stained handkerchief on the table between them. "Care to explain this?" he asked, his voice low. Lila's eyes widened, her breath quickening. I don't know how that got there." "Don't lie to me, Lila," Marlowe snapped. "This was buried in the same yard as Charles Herring's body. What are the odds it just happened to end up there?" Tears welled in her eyes. "I didn't kill him," she cried. "I swear, I didn't." "Then tell me the truth," Marlowe pressed. "What was your relationship with him? And why would your name be on this?" Lila's voice broke as she spoke. He threatened me. He said if I didn't do what he wanted, he'd ruin me. My scholarship, my reputation, everything. I hated him for it, but I didn't kill him. I couldn't." Marlowe studied her, the weight of her words settling in the room. She was scared, terrified even. But was it fear of the truth, or fear of being caught? Scene 3. While Lila's interrogation raised more questions than answers, Marlowe turned his focus to another suspect, Dean Harold Whitman. The contracts found in the first box painted a picture of a man complicit in Herring's schemes, and Marlowe knew Whitman was hiding something. The dean's office was eerily quiet when Marlowe arrived. Whitman was seated behind his desk, his hands folded neatly. "Detective," he said, his voice calm. "I assume you're here with more accusations." Marlowe didn't bother with pleasantries. "I know you were involved with Herring. I know he was blackmailing you. What I don't know is how far you were willing to go to stop him." Whitman's mask of composure slipped for a moment. "You think I killed him?" he asked, his tone sharp. "I think you had a motive," Marlowe replied. "And I think there's more to your story than you're letting on." Whitman leaned back in his chair, his gaze distant. Charles was difficult. He thrived on control, on holding power over people. But killing him? No, detective, that wasn't me. If anything, I should thank whoever did it. Marlowe narrowed his eyes. That's not exactly a denial. Whitman smirked, but it didn't reach his eyes. It's the truth. Scene 4, the professor's final move. Late that night, Marlowe sat in his office, the contents of the second box spread before him. The photographs showed Herring with various people, each one marked with handwritten notes. Weak link. Unreliable. Useful. It was clear that Herring had been tracking the people in his life, categorizing them as pawns in his game. But one photo stood out, a picture of Herring himself, standing in front of a chalkboard. Scrawled on the board behind him was a single phrase, "The game ends when I say it does." Marlowe's stomach turned. Was it possible that Herring had orchestrated his own death? Could the entire investigation be part of some twisted final act of control? As he pondered the implications, his phone buzzed. It was Officer Daniels. "Detective, you need to see this. We found something else at the estate." Scene 5. Back at the Herring estate, the forensic team had uncovered another journal. This one hidden inside a hollowed-out section of the study wall. The pages were filled with detailed plans, diagrams, and notes. One entry caught Marlowe's attention. "The ultimate betrayal is the sweetest victory. Let them believe they've won, and then take it all away." Marlowe's hands tightened around the journal. Herring wasn't just a victim. He was the architect of his own destruction, a puppet master who had underestimated the power of his puppets. Closing narration. Doctor. Charles Herring had spent his life weaving a web of lies and manipulation, pulling strings with calculated precision. But in the end, his web became a noose. The question now wasn't just who killed him, it was why. And as Marlowe dug deeper, he realized the truth was more dangerous than he'd ever imagined. Next time on Beneath the Ivy, the secrets come to light, the suspects close ranks, and the game takes a deadly turn. Chapter 5, The Chain of Betrayal. The discovery of the second journal turned the investigation on its head. Marlowe had spent weeks unraveling the enigma of Dr. Charles Herring's life, but this new find painted a more sinister picture. Herring hadn't just manipulated the people around him. He had meticulously planned his own demise, intending to expose their darkest secrets in the process. It was a game of betrayal, and Herring had set the rules. But someone had decided to break them. Scene 1, the journal's key players. Marlowe sat at his desk, the second journal open before him. Unlike the first, this one wasn't filled with cryptic musings or veiled threats. It was a ledger, a record of every manipulation, every blackmail, and every deal Herring had struck. Each page was a window into Herring's twisted mind. There were entries about faculty members, students, and even his family. But one name appeared more frequently than the others: Lila Carrington. Marlowe's jaw tightened as he read the details. Herring had isolated Lila, drawing her into his web with promises of mentorship and success. When she tried to pull away, he retaliated with threats to ruin her career. The final entry under her name was chilling. "The pawn becomes the queen only when the king falls." Marlowe leaned back in his chair, the weight of the words settling over him. Herring had seen Lila as a threat, but had she seen him as one too? Scene 2, confronting Lila again. Lila Carrington was brought in for questioning once more, her nerves frayed from the ongoing scrutiny. She sat across from Marlowe, her arms crossed, her eyes avoiding his. "This is becoming a habit," she said, her voice tinged with defiance. Marlowe placed the journal on the table, flipping it open to the pages about her. "Herring kept detailed notes on you," he said. "He thought you were dangerous, a threat to his control. Why would he feel that way?" Lila's gaze flickered to the journal, then back to Marlowe. "Because I fought back," she said simply. "I didn't let him win." "That's not the whole story," Marlowe pressed. "He didn't just see you as a threat. He saw you as an equal, someone who could challenge him. Did you?" Her jaw tightened. "I didn't kill him, if that's what you're asking." "Maybe not," Marlowe said, his voice softening. "But you wanted to." Lila didn't respond. The silence spoke volumes. Scene 3, Eleanor's desperation. While Lila's connection to Herring deepened the mystery, Marlowe turned his attention back to Eleanor Herring. The professor's widow had maintained her innocence, but her behavior grew more erratic with each passing day. Marlowe visited her at the Herring estate, where she was packing boxes in the study. "Leaving town?" he asked, his tone casual. Eleanor froze, her hands trembling as she folded a sweater. "I need a fresh start," she said. "This house, it's too much." "You know, I've been thinking," Marlowe said, stepping closer, "about what it must have been like living with him. He controlled everyone around him, didn't he? Even you." Eleanor's shoulders tensed. "You have no idea what it was like," she whispered. He made me feel small, like I didn't matter, but I didn't kill him." "Maybe not," Marlowe said, his voice low, "but you wanted to." Eleanor turned to face him, her eyes blazing with anger. "Of course I wanted to. Do you have any idea what he put me through? But I didn't. I couldn't." Marlowe studied her for a long moment. The pain in her voice was real, but so was the rage. The following day, Marlowe was called back to the estate. The forensic team had uncovered yet another grave, this one smaller, more haphazardly dug. Inside, they found what appeared to be shredded documents and charred remains of photographs. Among the debris, one piece of paper remained intact. It was a letter written in Herring's distinctive hand. "To those who think they've won, the truth always rises to the surface. And when it does, I'll be there to watch you fall." Marlowe felt a chill run down his spine. Herring's words weren't just a warning, they were a promise. Scene 5. The puppets turn on each other. As the investigation continued, tensions among the suspects grew. Lila and Eleanor began pointing fingers at each other, their accusations growing more heated with each interaction. Dean Whitman, too, found himself under increasing pressure, his polished facade beginning to crack. Marlowe watched as the web Herring had spun began to unravel, pulling everyone into its depths. The question wasn't just who had killed Herring, it was who had the most to gain from his death. Closing narration, Dr. Charles Herring had spent his life playing games, manipulating those around him with cruel precision. But in the end, his greatest game had turned against him. The deeper Detective Marlowe Gray delved into the mystery, the more he realized the truth wasn't just buried beneath the ivy. It was buried in the hearts of those who had once loved and trusted the professor. Next time on Beneath the Ivy, alliances crumble, secrets are exposed, and the final moves in Herring's game come into play. Chapter 6, The Final Moves. The walls were closing in. For Detective Marlowe Gray, every new discovery only deepened the labyrinth of lies surrounding Dr. Charles Herring's death. The suspects, Lila Carrington, Eleanor Herring, and Dean Harold Whitman, were entangled in the professor's manipulative games, each with their own secrets, each with their own reasons to see him gone. Marlowe sat in his dimly lit office, the second journal open before him. Herring's final entries read like a chessboard analysis, each move calculated, every player categorized. But one line stood out above the rest. "The truth is not what they think it is. It never is." The next morning, Marlowe received a call from forensics. A crucial detail in Eleanor Herring's alibi had been disproven. She claimed to have been at a charity gala the night her husband disappeared, but surveillance footage showed otherwise. Marlowe found Eleanor at a cafe, her pale hands wrapped around a steaming cup of tea. She didn't look up as he slid into the seat across from her. "Care to tell me why you lied about where you were the night Charles disappeared?" he asked. Eleanor's grip on the cup tightened, her knuckles whitening. "I didn't lie," she said, her voice barely audible. Marlowe tilted his head. "You weren't at the gala. The footage proves it. So where were you, Eleanor?" Tears welled in her eyes. "I was at a hotel," she admitted. "I needed time away from him. From his games, his control." Marlowe leaned forward, his tone sharp. "Why didn't you just say that? What are you hiding?" She shook her head, her tears spilling over. "You don't understand. If people knew what he was like behind closed doors, what he made me do." Marlowe's voice softened. "Eleanor, if you're protecting someone, now's the time to speak up." But she said nothing, her silence more telling than any confession. Scene 2, Leela's desperation. Meanwhile, Lila Carrington had become increasingly erratic. She arrived at the station unannounced, her eyes wild, clutching a folder of documents. "You need to see this," she said, thrusting the folder into Marlowe's hands. Inside were emails between her and Herring. At first, they were professional, but the tone shifted quickly. Herring's words became demanding, even threatening. "He wanted me to write his papers," Lila said, pacing the room. He promised me recommendations, connections, everything. And when I refused, he said he'd destroy me. He sent those emails to everyone, professors, students. He humiliated me. Marlowe flipped through the pages, his frown deepening. Why come forward now? He asked. Lila's voice broke. Because I'm scared. I didn't kill him, detective, but whoever did, they might think I know too much. Back at the Herring estate, the forensic team made another discovery, an old hidden passage in the study. The entrance was concealed behind a bookshelf, its existence revealed by scratches on the floor where the shelf had been moved repeatedly. Marlowe entered the narrow hallway, the air thick with dust and the faint scent of mildew. At the end of the passage was a small, windowless room. Inside, they found a collection of tapes, each labeled with a name, Eleanor, Lila, Whitman. Marlowe's stomach churned as he played the first tape. Herring's voice crackled through the speakers, his tone cold and calculated. You think you can escape me, Eleanor? You think I don't know what you've done? I hold your secrets, and you'll do well to remember that. The second tape was worse. Lila, you're smarter than the others, but don't forget who gave you that chance. Without me, you're nothing. And then the third. Whitman, your reputation is fragile. It would be a shame if the truth came out, wouldn't it? The tapes painted a damning picture. Herring hadn't just manipulated his victims. He had recorded their confessions, their weaknesses, their betrayals. Scene 4, the dean's breaking point. Marlowe confronted Dean Whitman with the tape bearing his name. The dean's polished demeanor cracked as the recording played, Herring's voice echoing in the room. He was going to ruin me, Whitman admitted, his voice trembling. He had evidence. Affairs, financial improprieties, things I thought were buried. He was going to destroy everything I'd built. So you killed him? Marlowe asked bluntly. Whitman's eyes widened. No. I wanted to. God knows I wanted to. But I didn't have the courage. Marlowe leaned closer. Who did then? Who had the courage to stop him? Scene 5. The web tightens. As the evidence mounted, Marlowe realized that Herring's death wasn't the end of his game. It was the climax. He had orchestrated everything, pushing his pawns to the brink, knowing someone would eventually snap. The suspects, Eleanor, Lila, and Whitman, were caught in a trap of their own making. Each had a motive, each had an opportunity, and each had fallen victim to Herring's control. But one question remained: who made the final move? Closing narration, Dr. Charles Herring's life was built on lies, manipulation, and control. But in the end, it was his own arrogance that sealed his fate. As Detective Marlowe Gray delves deeper into the tangled web of betrayal, the truth inches closer. But so does the danger. Next time on Beneath the Ivy, the final revelation, the ultimate betrayal, and the shocking truth that changes everything. Chapter 7, The Ultimate Betrayal. Detective Marlowe Gray was nearing the end of a labyrinth he wasn't sure he wanted to escape. The deeper he ventured into Dr. Charles Herring's life, the more the lines between victim and perpetrator blurred. Herring wasn't just a manipulator. He was a maestro, orchestrating the lives of those around him until the day someone silenced his symphony. But the question remained, who delivered the final note? Scene 1, The Secret in the Tapes. Marlowe sat in his office, the tapes from Herring's hidden room spread out before him. Each recording was a confession, a weapon Herring had wielded to maintain control. As Marlowe played the tapes again, something struck him, a pattern. Herring's voice was methodical, but his tone shifted subtly depending on the person he was addressing. To Eleanor, he was scathing, his words laced with venom. To Lila, he was mocking, challenging her intelligence. To Whitman, he was cold, almost clinical. Marlowe rewound the tape labeled Eleanor, replaying a specific section. You think you can escape me, Eleanor? You think you can bury the past? It always comes back. Always. The word bury hung in the air. It wasn't just a threat, it was a clue. Scene 2, Eleanor's final secret. Marlowe confronted Eleanor Herring at the estate, where she was finishing the last of her packing. She looked up as he entered, her face pale and drawn. You found something, she said, her voice hollow. Marlowe nodded, holding up the tape. This, Herring's words. He wasn't just threatening you. He was daring you. Eleanor's hands trembled. I don't know what you mean. Marlowe stepped closer, his voice firm. He knew you'd break, Eleanor. He pushed you to your limit. But instead of walking away, you did what he wanted. You gave him the ultimate betrayal. Tears streamed down her face as she collapsed into a chair. He was a monster, she whispered. He controlled every part of my life, every decision, every thought. And when I finally stood up to him, he laughed. He said I was weak, that I'd never be free of him. Marlowe's tone softened. So, you killed him? Eleanor looked up, her eyes filled with anguish. I didn't mean to. He said he'd ruin our children, expose things that weren't true. I couldn't let him win. Scene 3, the confrontation with Lila. While Eleanor's confession painted a compelling picture, Marlowe wasn't convinced she had acted alone. Herring's death was too calculated, too precise. There was someone else pulling strings in the background. He called Lila Carrington to the station, his questions cutting to the heart of her relationship with the professor. You wanted to destroy him, Marlowe said, his eyes locking onto hers. You wanted to take back the power he stole from you. So you helped Eleanor, didn't you? Lila shook her head vehemently. No, I hated him, but I didn't kill him. Then why were you at the estate the night he disappeared? Marlowe asked. Her face went pale. I wasn't. Don't lie to me, Lila, Marlowe interrupted. I've got witnesses who saw you leaving the property that night. What were you doing there? She exhaled shakily, her facade crumbling. Eleanor called me. She said she needed help. When I got there, he was already gone. She begged me to help her bury him. The dean's desperation. While the pieces began to fall into place, Marlowe couldn't ignore Dean Whitman. The man had the most to lose if Herring's secrets were exposed, and his increasingly erratic behavior made him a prime suspect. Marlowe confronted Whitman in his office, slamming the journal onto the desk. You knew this would happen, Marlowe said. You knew Herring's games would catch up to him, and you let it play out because it was easier than taking responsibility. Whitman's hands shook as he poured himself a drink. You think I wanted this? He snapped. Charles had a way of making you feel powerless. He knew everything about everyone, and when he decided you were no longer useful, he made sure you knew it. So you killed him to protect yourself, Marlowe pressed. Whitman's laugh was hollow. If I'd had the courage to do it, I'd admit it. But no, detective, I didn't kill him. I just hoped someone else would. Scene 5, The Shocking Truth. Back at the station, Marlowe reviewed his notes. The evidence against Eleanor and Lila was damning, but something didn't sit right. The precision of Herring's death, the calculated burial, the meticulous destruction of evidence suggested a level of control neither woman possessed. Then it hit him. Herring had planned everything, including his own death. The second journal wasn't just a ledger. It was a script. He had pushed Eleanor, Lila, and Whitman to their breaking points, knowing one of them would act. But the final twist was the most chilling. Herring had left a note in the hidden passage addressed to Marlowe. To the detective reading this, you've done well to get this far. But know this, what you think is the truth is merely another illusion. The real game begins now. Marlowe's blood ran cold. Herring wasn't just playing with his victims. He was playing with the detective himself. Closing narration. Dr. Charles Herring's death was a masterstroke in a game of manipulation that extended beyond the grave. The suspects were pawns, their actions carefully orchestrated by a man who thrived on control. But as Detective Marlowe Gray uncovered the final layer of Herring's plan, he realized the game was far from over. Next time on Beneath the Ivy, the truth unravels, alliances shift, and the final player steps into the light.